The Guardian.
And welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra with Faye Carruthers keeping the seat warm for Max Rushton, who'll need an electric blanket on it when he returns on Thursday from sunning himself like an Adonis in Australia. Hopefully no one dressed in a Leeds United tracksuit spying on him and his budgie smugglers, as Marcelo Bielsa admits to peeking on every single opponent this season while defiantly insisting it's not illegal and not cheating. Elsewhere, we delve into problems in North London with rumours Arsenal's head of recruitment Sven Mislintat could be on his way, and try and help Tottenham find some fit and free forwards before they face Fulham. We'll wave goodbye to Wagner and, of course, look ahead to the rest of this weekend's Premier League games as well. All that and more in today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. So this feels weird, sitting in the big chair today and looking that way to the gallery. Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Hi Faye.
Have you had your meatballs recently?
That feels like a loaded question. No, I had a very normal breakfast with like muesli and yogurt and things. So I guess I feel a bit like Mark Langdon after an apple. Like it's probably not a bad idea all around. It just doesn't feel right.
I'm slightly disappointed that after the last time we met and I questioned you on the sauce with your meatballs, that you didn't bring some in for us to try.
But the ones I make are only for Christmas. So you can't make them outside of Christmas.
Says who? Make up your
tradition.
Own rules. Okay, Pat Labandini, lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you. I'm led to believe you might have had a more interesting breakfast this morning, Faye.
My breakfast was weird.
It wasn't. It was fine.
Yeah, it fits. It fits Lars. Lars could have it, but it was a chicken burger with haddock, with spring greens, and some guacamole. Just a bit of a mesh.
Magnificent.
Not impressed, were you, Mr. Glendenning?
I'm struggling to figure out which is more disgusting, the image of Max Rushton in Speedos and nothing else, or the idea of having haddock for breakfast, or indeed any time.
That's such a dangerous thing to say when you know you're going to be away with him for two nights.
And also says the man who has just told me before we started that he spent his holiday in Malta in an Irish pub.
It was raining. In an Irish pub watching the darts.
Anyway, let's get on with part one. And where else to start but that amazing press briefing from Marcelo Bielsa last night. He called this unexpected briefing for 5 p.m. Some rumours flying around Twitter that he was about to resign. What actually happened, though, was that he admitted to spying on every opponent Leeds have faced this season. He then went on to give an insight into the work that he does along with his analysts ahead of every game. He said, "Why did I send someone to watch them? Just because I thought I wasn't violating the norm. All the information I need to clarify my tactics, gather without watching the training session of the opponent. But we feel guilty if we don't work enough. Watching it allows us to have less anxiety. And in my case, I am stupid enough to allow this kind of behaviour." I would love your thoughts on this, Barry Glendenning.
Well, there seems to have been a huge level of amazement at the amount of work he puts in. And I don't think that would come as a surprise to anyone who knows Jonathan Wilson and is therefore very familiar with his work and has been for a long time. He has an astonishing work ethic. At his interview for the Leeds job, his future employers wanted to get an idea of how much he knew about the Championship. So he randomly, I think it was a fixture between Burton Albion and Bolton, he mentioned. He spoke about their formations in a game they'd played. Then he spoke about the formations each side had used throughout the previous season, and then proceeded to do the same for every other team in the Championship. And needless to say, they were suitably impressed. But what he did yesterday was really fascinating for the journalists lucky enough to be there. I'd love to have been in on it. It seemed like a very interesting masterclass, but not hugely surprising that he knows that much about Derby County or any other team, to be honest. And he probably does know more about Derby County than Frank Lampard.
Well, what's interesting as well, they play Stoke this weekend, and obviously Nathan Jones has only been in charge for 3 games, and he said that he's instead gone back and looked at 26 Luton Town games to find out what Nathan Jones might do this weekend. Paolo, he ended the briefing saying, "I'm not cheating. I knew everything I needed to know." Is it cheating?
Yeah, no, it's not cheating. I think he For someone who, you know, joked about this not speaking English perfectly, I thought he actually elocuted it very well. You know, it's not cheating, but you can, but perhaps he feels, oh, maybe I misunderstood the morality element and how people will perceive it as a moral thing. It's categorically not cheating, and it's not in the rules. Like there is nothing written down anywhere saying you can't stand in a public area outside a private training ground that, by the way, is overlooked anyway by buildings. So you could just sit in someone's flat and look out the window if you wanted to and watch. There's nothing saying you can't do that. Is there something, you know, morally gray area about it? Personally, I would still say no, but I think that's, you know, the question that is the real one is, are people sort of morally offended by this, the idea that you would sort of go to those lengths? To me, I don't know. I mean, obviously I cover Italian football on regularly, and I think that certainly the culture there is different. There was a famous case a few years ago with a Genoa youth goalkeeping coach who got caught in camouflage fatigues at Sampdoria's training grounds. And actually, he did get suspended by the club for it. So once it happened, they were a bit, unlike Bielsa, who's gone, yeah, we do this all the time. They were a bit like, oh, what's this about? Which was a bit insincere. But, you know, I remember going to Coverciano, the national training base, a couple of years ago, and chatting to them there and them talking about how different managers have sort of managed that area of the national team. And apparently when Antonio Conte was there, it was, yeah, whenever the senior national team trained, they had to put up walls because he was of that mindset that, oh, this is a public thing, people can look in. And I always tend to think that if you're the sort of manager who's thinking that, then probably that's because you've thought it on the other side and thought, well, let's go and watch other people as well. But yeah, I don't know. To me, it's sort of a non-story, and the interesting bit of it actually is as Baz says, it's listening to Bielsa give this sort of big long talk about all the preparation that goes into it. I think some of it was a little bit disingenuous. You know, he sort of made this point of, oh, we've got all this information, so actually the spy doesn't tell us anything. But of course the spy can still tell you something. I mean, you know, he said, why do I do this? Oh, because I'm stupid. No, you don't do it because you're stupid. You do it because it's another thing that might just give you a piece of information that lends you an edge. And in football,
Harry Wilson, for example, would he play?
Yeah, and in football, these marginal gains can make a difference sometimes because that's how it works in elite sport. But I love it personally. I think as well as anything, look, like, we're all guilty, myself certainly, at times of taking this sport way too seriously. It's entertainment, and this is great entertainment.
Were you entertained, Lars?
Very, quite entertained. It's been often billed this as a sort of a split between the proper football men and the sort of progressive thinkers. But I thought there was one line in Bielsa's press conference that could kind of build a bridge between the two. I'm reading here, he says, in my eyes, I feel I'm innocent. I don't feel I'm trying to get a moral advantage. I feel I have done something not forbidden. I don't have bad intentions. Is it right? No, I don't say that. But we have to analyse the behaviours, taking into account the intentions of the person behaving in this way. So what he's basically saying is there wasn't any intent and he's not that kind of manager, which is, I think, very sort of a proper football man approach to it. Now, the thing that I get slightly annoyed with is the Derby County side of it, how they seem to be quite indignant about things. But they're taking training somewhere that's clearly in view of the public. Like, the fella, it's been confirmed, the fella was standing on public land. He wasn't trespassing. Like, if I'm in my front room and I don't want people looking in on me, I close the blinds, right? So if it's really important to Derby that no one sees them training, then you put up a wall or plant some trees or something.
Which a lot of clubs do.
Right.
But if you're Frank Lampard, for example, and you've got a room full of journalists at Thorpe Arch training ground with Bielsa taking you through all of Derby's stats, you'd be a little bit annoyed, wouldn't you?
But those stats, I thought that was slightly overblown because positional data and formation, I mean, just subscribe to Y Scout. Like, it's not extremely weird secrets. I thought in terms of how Lampard reacted, I'd like to compare it to when Werder Bremen flew a drone over Hoffenheim's training ground earlier this season, when their Hoffenheim's young manager Julian Nagelsmann just said, I'm not really angry at the analyst for doing his job. It's commendable if they're trying to do everything they can, trying to spy on the opposition. So it's possible to have a little bit more chill about this.
He was incandescent with rage, though, wasn't he, Bielsa, at the reaction of everybody?
Well, I can kind of understand it. I mean, a lot of the people getting on their high horse about, you know, the morality of what he did are senior journalists who regularly follow England and have absolutely no problem whatsoever trying to do the exact same thing and leaked team sheets, and they deny all accusations of treachery very emphatically. So, you know, it's just funny. I find it very entertaining. And there's a bit of pomposity on both sides. People saying there's nothing wrong, you know, very pompously, and people saying it's terrible, it's an outrage, but it's just funny, it's entertaining.
So with that in mind, do you think this happens more than we know about?
Yeah, I'm certain that Bielsa's Leeds are not the only team in the Football League that have done something like this. I mean, again, you could be in someone's flat overlooking a lot of training grounds in this country and watching out the window. To me, like, one of the, you know, the sort of interesting side notes of it actually was just, you know, not that we should surprise us in 2019 that clubs have all this data on all these teams, but again, Bielsa sort of saying, I know all of the players and all 24 championship clubs. And I remember it's only 2010, I don't know why this one sticks in my head, but actually it was before a good Champions League campaign for Tottenham as well, but Harry Redknapp, before a game against Young Boys, talking about, oh, that left-footed guy, and he didn't know his name, and it's like he didn't know the name of the team he was just about to play. Mm. And I think there's a real contrast there. Again, we talk about, you know, cliched versions, not the saying this covers everyone, but of real football men and the modern sort of approach to the game, and it's just so sort of drastically different.
What I loved was this really random photograph that somebody posted, who was in the press conference last night, of this table full of like black and red notebooks, like stacked on top of each other of all this stuff. It was really old school, and a few people were saying who were in the briefing that it was almost like watching a genius at work. Is that overstating it?
I don't think it is. I mean, the thing is, he hasn't won a huge amount as a manager, but various managers who are at the top of their game are huge admirers of his, almost disciples, Pep Guardiola among them. He, you know, he's an innovator, and I wouldn't say it's a stretch to call him a genius. He comes from a very successful family. I think he's ferocious work ethic, and, you know, Leeds players train from 9 a.m. till 7 or 8 in the evening, or they did certainly in pre-season, which is kind of unheard of at football clubs. His mother apparently drove him very hard as a kid. His sister is a very successful architect. His older brother is used to be a minister, I think, in Argentina, government minister. And, I would say he's a genius. I mean, I'd never really heard of him until Jonathan Wilson started talking about him about 10 years ago. And I think a lot of people in this country didn't really come on the radar until maybe he was at Athletic Bilbao or managing Chile at the 2010 World Cup, I think. But he's very exciting. Watching his teams play is very exciting. And for all that, he hasn't enjoyed huge amounts of success.
But is this season, you know, potentially gone, Lars?
Maybe. I mean, the thing that's often happened with his teams is that they burn out about two-thirds of the way through the season because of his methods are very, very demanding, because his character is very demanding. I do think the players like it that he's such an obsessive, because when you're asking the players to run and work as hard as he does, it's good for them to see that the manager in his own way is actually working extremely hard as well and putting in the hours and analysing everything. I think if you contrast that to a lot of managers who's off to the golf course after taking training, I mean, players respect them a lot more when they can see their bosses working as hard as they are. And he's definitely an obsessive. I mean, there's a fun story about when Leeds were trying to hire him, they called him in Argentina and they couldn't get him on the phone, so they left a message, and the next day they called him and he picked up the phone. At that point he'd already watched 7 Leeds games to sort of try to figure out what he was dealing with here. So he's clearly abnormal in the amount of detail he goes into. But I would also add to that it's not that unusual. I mean, some of the reaction to this lecture was like, oh my god, this is mind-blowing stuff. Like, clubs of that stature do a lot of opposition analysis and stuff. Yeah. This is not uncommon. It's probably a little bit uncommon that the head coach is as personally involved with it as Bielsa probably is. But you think back at when Leicester won the title, no one spoke about this, but Ranieri did a lot of this stuff. Vardy explained that in an interview a while back, that before team meetings, Ranieri had been up all night watching 50, 60 clips of just one of the opposition players, and he could tell you what he'd done in all of them. So it's something top managers do, but it's certainly true that Bielsa is a bit more of an obsessive than most.
Yes, most definitely. It does rub off on the players, though, just as a final point, because, you know, I've watched them a lot this season. The amount of times they've come back late from games when they've been trailing, the players have that never give up kind of obsessive, you know, attitude now that maybe they didn't have in the past. Anyway, let's move on to another manager who's departed the Premier League this season, David Wagner, leaving Huddersfield after just over 3 years in charge. He took charge back in November 2015, Huddersfield 18th in the Championship, replaced Chris Powell. Apparently, Wagner told his players after last Saturday's goalless draw at Cardiff that he planned to resign. He got them promoted, don't forget, via the playoffs in his first full season in charge, and they were the first team to be promoted to the Premier League despite having a negative goal difference. Do we feel like this was inevitable?
I suppose it's a... It's almost a philosophical point, isn't it? I mean, I don't think it's inevitable they're going to go down. I think the Huddersfield have so far exceeded what's reasonable to expect of them over the last couple of years that, barring something truly miraculous, they had to come down to earth a little bit. And it's a team that clearly can't score goals, that lacks the absolute quality required to get the ball in the net as regularly as they need to in the Premier League, that is still relying on players, you think, from that first sort of wave of signings he made a couple of years ago, guys like Christopher Schindler, Chris Lowe in defence. Like these aren't players who, with the best will in the world, they're not the foundations of a sort of solid, you know, established Premier League side. Was it inevitable that he goes? I think that it's very possible that a club could take a view that, you know, taking into account the things I've just said, well, all right, well, if we go down again, he's still a good manager, even if we go down again. But I think sometimes in football, it's there's a bigger picture thing going on, which is, well, what's going to be best next for his career? To stick around and go down and try and do the same thing again? Or is it to take another step somewhere else? And is it time just to refresh and try and start over a little bit as a club as well? Because you've had this sort of era of punching above your weight, doing more than you could expect, and now you just need to hit the reset button a little bit and start planning for the next stage, which is realistically almost certainly going to be a season in the Championship at least.
With that in mind, would you say, playing devil's advocate slightly, is it admirable that he decided to resign when he did, to give Huddersfield a chance to have somebody come in and then, you know, reassess it in the summer? Or do you think he just didn't want relegation on his CV?
Ooh, that's a very cynical view. That hadn't even crossed my mind, to be honest, but it's kind of interesting. I think he was just kind of broken. After Huddersfield lost against Fulham, I think, was it 3 games ago, the players just looked like beaten dockets, you know, and as did Wagner. He had been talking a good game, you know, in post-match interviews up to that, but he that really seemed to knock the stuffing out of them as a collective and him individually. And then he was uncharacteristically bitter after the draw against Cardiff when he went on a post-match rant against the ref, which was kind of out of character for him. And with, you know, having seen them, it didn't come as a huge surprise. I mean, I thought he'd been sacked when I saw the initial tweet from Huddersfield, because, you know, mutual consent, we all know what that means usually in football. But then reading the statement, it became clear that, no, he had resigned. I think he offered to stay till the end of the season, and then they decided, no, I'll just go now and we'll get someone else in. So,
yeah, so who are they going to get in? The club are apparently going to announce their next manager following their game against Manchester City, of all games to have this weekend. That's not a good one. Some names to throw about. Apologies if I'm not pronouncing this right. You can correct me. Jan Stewart is the favourite, apparently currently in charge at Borussia Dortmund 2, which was the job that Wagner was in before he moved to Huddersfield. Slavisa Jokanovic, Mikel Arteta and Isa Karanka in the mix too. Who would you have, Lars?
I think the important thing for Huddersfield and Dean Hoyle is that they continue in a similar vein in terms of the philosophy that's been put in place. And I'm not familiar with the work of the current Dortmund 2 second team manager, but it wouldn't surprise me if his sort of background was similar to that of David Wagner and could bring in a lot of the same principles and take that further. That would make a lot of sense. I certainly don't expect Huddersfield to throw a lot of money after one of these established names that go about on go round and round on the managerial roundabout. That would seem very much out of step with how the club does things. I think it's worth just, Paolo mentioned it, but let's talk a little bit more about what an achievement it was for them to go up. I mean, when they signed all these players in 2006, I mean, Chris Schindler was the record signing at £1.8 million. Now, the season before that, there were seven clubs in the Championship who spent more than that on just agent fees, you know. According to the owner, they had the sixth or seventh lowest budget in the Championship, and they went up. I mean, that's an incredible achievement. And they didn't bet the farm on staying up by signing loads of players. They've tried to run it in a way so that if they do go down again, they're not screwed financially. And I think it's very, very savvy. And for a club of their stature, it's absolutely the right way of going about it.
And you know, and this isn't to diminish the achievement, but in this in this age where we obsess with stats like expected goals, I mean, there's a team that did come up with a -2 goal difference, you know, that didn't score in the playoffs, that won via shootouts. I mean, there was a... that's not to diminish it, because actually I think that this is why we play the games, and there is that element of emotion and what he's done as a manager to get them to win games, even when perhaps, like, when you go through the teams, even in the Championship, in some of those playoff games, end of season games, you think, wow, they're a little bit overmatched. But yeah, they're not structurally built to be where they're not structurally built to be a Premier League side right now, and I think that most of their fans would agree with that, and frankly are sort of even, I think, feel like the people who run the club have been sort of blown away that Wagner was able to get them as far as he was. And it's sad because this feels like the end of that, but I don't think it's by any means a disaster for Huddersfield as a club to go back into the Championship when no one expected them to be here this soon.
What about Wagner himself, though? Because, you know, his stock, you could say, with all of that in mind, is still quite high. So what's he going to do?
Well, I'd say he's probably going to take a break. He'll have no shortage of offers either here or in Germany. I mean, he has turned down approaches in the past from, you know, he was linked with moves elsewhere immediately after they got promoted and again last summer, and he decided to stay put. Possibly with the benefit of hindsight, he might now think, oh, maybe I should have gone last summer, but He leaves with his head held very high, and he will have no shortage of offers whatsoever, I'd imagine.
Not a great, if you're a Huddersfield fan, weekend in prospect, because you've got Manchester City on Sunday, so it might just be about to get worse. City, of course, had a straightforward win over Wolves on Monday, keeping them 4 points behind Liverpool. Who watched that game? Blank faces. Wonderful. What were you all doing on Monday night?
I was watching Luther. I've started watching the box set. So, apologies. It's very unprofessional of me. I just couldn't take any more football after a weekend of too much of it.
I was watching similarly one-sided Coppa Italia games. So,
I came in a bit. I'd walked the dog, and I came in sort of 20 minutes after it started, and it was 1-0 City and a red card to Wolves. And I was like, nah, you know what? There are other things I could be doing.
I did
right
pretty
now.
Much the same thing. So, yeah, Willy Bolly sent off after 19 minutes. Gabriel Jesus scored twice. That's 7 goals in the last 3 games for him. Although, just as a little asterisk, that does include the 7-0 FA Cup win over Rotherham and the 9-0 over Burton. But it is his 5th goal in the Premier League this season. Are we seeing Jesus come to some kind of form finally?
He just seems to be happier. I think he was quite homesick and alone in Manchester, and now his family have joined him, and he's got a spring in his step. You know, he's clearly a good player, and given opportunities, you know, I think I'd score given opportunities in that team. But no, I wouldn't. But you know what I mean.
Aren't they set to go back, though? Aren't they set to go to go home, I thought?
Who?
His family. His friends and family.
Oh, I wasn't aware they were on sort of only over for a brief sojourn. But Manchester City should perhaps pay for them to stay a little longer. I think that was the main talking point from that game, which I have seen, was appeared to be the Bolly tackle, which exercised a lot of Wolves fans, because assorted players from other teams, Virgil van Dijk at Liverpool springs to mind, have done the same thing and not got red cards. So But it, by all accounts, it wasn't great. But
it did occur to me watching the highlights that it was the kind of tackle that if you were the very likable and injury-prone captain of Man City, you may not get sent off.
Right.
Well, but this is the thing. That's what all the Liverpool fans were jumping on. Oh, why didn't Kompany get sent off? Yeah. But of course, Van Dijk should have been sent off against Napoli. So it's every club has these things. They were all red cards for me. All these fouls we're talking about should be red cards. Some of them were given, some of them weren't. That's football. Referees don't always see things in the moment.
No, very much. And I'm sure we'll get onto that later as well. But that, for now, is part one.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian subscriptions.
Part two, and we have another guest with us because Amy Lawrence joins us in the studio to talk all things Arsenal. Now, Sven Mislintat, one of the highest regarded scouts in world football, only been at Arsenal just over a year after joining from Borussia Dortmund in November 2017. His role was supposed to evolve into one of a technical director. He looks to be going out the door. Position has become untenable. What's the background, Amy?
Well, I heard someone saying, there's been a few comments, rightly probably going, some scout leaving, so what? And in the kind of grander scheme of the way we get excited about football, it wouldn't appear in itself. I mean, probably most people prior to this week might not have heard that much of the name Sven Mislintat, least of all known that much more detail about who he was and what he actually does. But it's a bigger picture scenario where he was brought in. If you rewind a bit to those heady days when Arsene Wenger was still in charge and Ivan Gazidis was still doing his bit, trying to lead the club, they didn't get on brilliantly, and this led to a situation where it was a bit of old versus new. Arsene had his way of doing things. Ivan thought that there should be a brave new world, and Arsenal needed to modernise to try and join that brave new world. And he came up with the very famous phrase, "catalyst for change," which was something that from time to time got, not least probably by me, thrown back in his face at times. But the idea was that Arsenal needed to sort of shape up and get with a slightly more forward-looking programme. And part of this was restructuring internally, not just the management side, or forget about what's going on the pitch, but off the pitch. And they have gone about a kind of radical upgrade in that department, bringing in lots of new people, promoting lots of other people, spending quite a lot of money on different experts and so on to try and prepare for a future within their famous self-sustaining model, which Stan Kroenke believes is the way to run the club, and still be competitive. Some might argue you can't do those two things, but that's probably for another day. In any case, Sven was headhunted because his pedigree in terms of working within a relatively constrained budget at Borussia Dortmund, who are a club who operates slightly outside that financial superpower elite, but still managed to be really competitive and produce outstanding players that they sometimes bring in not for that much money in the bigger scheme of things, but have a fantastic resale value as they develop and evolve. You think of Lewandowski, Aubameyang, Kagawa. Mislintat was not just the guy who went and spotted people that everyone didn't know about, who, this kind of diamond eye, as they called it, for a future player, but he was also part of the inner sanctum at Dortmund when they went through a period of their own transformation and regeneration. They were nearly bankrupt not that long ago. They were facing a pretty difficult future. And within a matter of years, they're in Champions League finals and winning the Bundesliga ahead of Bayern Munich. On the pitch, that had a lot to do with Jürgen Klopp and people of that ilk. Off the pitch, it had a lot to do with people like Sven and others who were running the business side and doing the clever football thinking. There's something about Sven that actually reminds me a bit of Jürgen Klopp. He's a bit rock and roll. He's a bit of a dude. He doesn't turn up in a suit and tie or a tracksuit. He's in sort of jeans and casual sort of a guy, long hair, likes his music, will go out for a pint. He's not a kind of typical football guy, which I think is exactly why he's quite good at his job, in a human way. And he's really interested in the bigger picture, in what goes on inside a football club, the relationship with supporters, how you can make something happen in the way that sort of makes Klopp tick. He's interested when you're potentially signing a player, you know, if he's a bit of a bad lad, well, why? And can we help him? Rather than...
Hence Aubameyang, you know, coming in the January after he joined.
Exactly. So anyway, that's a bit of a background to him. And he was possibly the most exciting of all the new people who have come into the club to try and run Arsenal in the last 18 months. And given freedom, given a bit of rope to try out his own ideas and do his thing, I think that somebody like that had a chance of actually culturally changing a bit around the place that got a bit stale, quite apart from the fact that you're hoping he's going to go and find another Lucas Torreira or Matteo Guendouzi or whoever it might be. You know, his best thing is looking at the slightly younger, not yet fully formed talent, not a Socrates or a, you know, these are stopgap stuff that Arsenal sort of had to do, or Lichtstein or whatever, you know. But he came in under Gazidis. That was his line manager. He was working for him, essentially, and the plan was pretty clear that Arsene Wenger, oh, hater of director of footballs, once that change had made, then bringing in a sort of proper technical director was going to be the way Arsenal wanted to go. And I think Sven was it was pretty clearly laid out to him by Ivan that would be for Sven.
So why? How have we got to this situation?
Well,
where he's
Ivan's
now
left and gone to AC Milan, and he was replaced by two people to do his job. Raul Sanyeli, who came from Barcelona, and Vinay Venkatesham, who came from within the club to do the more business side of stuff. And with them leading the ship, that technical director role that they've been seeking to fill looks like it's not open to Sven anymore. So instead of feeling like he was coming into the club to join a project and get a, you know, quite quick sort of promotion, I think perhaps it feels a bit more like a demotion, because if you bring in a director of football and you're a head of recruitment, you haven't got the say on transfers anyway. So you're not even really being trusted to do the job that you did before you were hopefully going to get a slightly more responsible job.
How frustrating is that from his point of view, that he's been promised one thing, two others come in. Why can't they see what you've just said, potentially, Arsenal could be like? Why can't they see that?
Don't know. I think that the most critical question for me is, Borussia Dortmund is such an obvious sort of a role model for Arsenal at where they are right now, doing that kind of smart business. And, you know, when Raul and Vinay have spoken about their ideas for the club, what they describe really resonates with that whole Dortmund style for the clubs just outside the megabucks. Operating really smart, making sure all the decisions are really well-resourced and really, you know, efficient. You know, be streamlined, don't make mistakes as much as you possibly can, be really clear about where you're going, try to make decisions where you feel so sure that you're doing a clever business decision that doesn't maybe cost you that much money but might earn you money in the future to then put more fuel in the tank, so to speak. And it's obvious to me from the outside looking in that Sven seems like a perfect person to be part of that. Why they've gone looking for something else, I don't know. But I think that this time next year, a little bit further down the line, when they eventually appoint a technical director, you'll get a bit more clues. But maybe that model isn't the model that they want, which was the model that Ivan wants. But it doesn't really make sense that they would want to try and operate in a different way, because they're certainly not going to suddenly wake up and take a phone call from the US where Stan says, hey, have some millions. I mean, that's not happening. So
Arsenal seems like a kind of stuffy institution. Is he maybe a bit too much of a maverick if he stuck on a shirt and tie and cut his hair? Would they think more highly of him?
That's a brilliant point, Barry. And I don't know the answer to that, but he's definitely got some maverick in him. And I think, as Liverpool have exemplified with Klopp, you go with it if you've
he
got a guy
like exactly
that. And then people buy into it and the whole thing takes on a life form of itself when the explosions
Absolutely.
Start happening. But I guess if you're the manager of the football team, you've probably got a bit more leeway to show your character and charisma, and if that's part of how you bring people along for the ride, as in the case of Jurgen Klopp, then fantastic. I don't know whether if you're in a slightly more background or off the pitch place, you're supposed to behave in a different way. I don't know.
The thing that just confuses me is that given Arsenal's finances and what is going to be their job for the next decade or so is trying to compete with teams who've got stronger resources. Of all the key people they've brought in, they've marginalised the one person who has a proven track record in doing just that. I mean, as an outsider to the situation, that seems completely baffling.
Well, he's not been fired. It should be sort of said.
Well, marginalised.
But yeah, I mean, it strikes me that this is a bit about individual power plays, right, as well. I mean, Sanjehi, unless I've misunderstood, I don't think he's going to be going out there and being scouting players himself. That's not what he intends to do. But it might be about getting his own man in to do that. It's about having someone who he thinks is his guy rather than somebody else's guy. Would that be a fair...
These are all concepts that make loads of sense. But, I mean, until Arsenal come out and maybe explain a little bit, which may never happen, we're just guessing. But for whatever reason, and I think it's a regrettable one, thinking of it feels like an opportunity missed for a club like Arsenal. You know, Barry used the word stuffy. They seem to me, after in the post-Wenger years, to be a club that's really looking for a new identity. And when you spoke to people in those first weeks and months of the beginning of the season, everyone was sort of dead excited to feel a new energy. I mean, if you spoke to anybody who worked at the club, more or less at any department, you could sense that they were genuinely excited, hoping that this was going to all feel a bit different and there was going to be something fresh and new and ambitious to cling to.
You don't hear that often with other clubs, such a fanfare when a head of recruitment comes in. You don't kind of get that, do you? So I can see why they might be disappointed. And then I heard something about the Arsenal former midfielder Edu being linked with the job as well.
Yeah, I don't know how credible that is in terms of if it'll actually happen. I think they were definitely interested in him, and he's done a good job with the Brazilian national team. But he's a slightly different kind of a guy. It's not really like for like. But I can understand if you want to bring in Edu as technical director, as opposed to a different style, you know, someone who's come from more of a scouting background. But then if you lose that scout altogether, then that you've got a bit of a void in that department. Mm. So they've got to do something else in that way.
That Sven dude sounds like exactly the kind of person Manchester United could do with.
I think it's a lot of clubs who could do with him. He's a really, really impressive person. If you get to hear him talk football, you can see what... He's a bit of an original thinker, and there aren't that many of them about, let's be honest. I've obviously missed the best part of this podcast because you've done Bielsa. I'm sure people have already switched off by now or fallen asleep or whatever. This is, you know, this is the boring bit after Bielsa. But, you know, when you get someone who's a bit original in the way they do things in an environment that's analysed to death, as football is...
It captures imagination, doesn't it?
I think
it gets people excited. Well, I mean, exactly what you mean.
He's being very heavily linked with going to Bayern, which makes an enormous amount of sense, given that's another institution where things appear to have gone a bit stale and you have an ageing squad who've grown old together a bit and you need a big revamp and some fresh ideas and stuff. So that would make a bunch of sense.
Elsewhere with Arsenal, coming out today that Unai Emery has told Mesut Ozil that it's going to be in his best interests to leave the club and that the board shares that viewpoint.
Mesut Ozil's bankers disagree.
It's a big old statement. I think that, again, rewinding slightly, Arsenal are right now in a position where everything they did this time last year is really impacting on what they feel that they can or can't do now. They had Alexis Sanchez and Mesut Ozil running down their contracts in the Aaron Ramsey position, if you will, this time last year, and dealt with them as best they felt they could at that time, one of which was the Mkhitaryan Sanchez swap, and the other was to give Mesut a new contract. I think they probably felt we can't lose them both at the same time. Like, given the pressure they were under, and you actually think about how much negativity there was around that sort of dog end of the Wenger era.
But £350,000 a week.
But that's a farewell present from Ivan Gazidis, you've got to say. It's not up, not quite up there with the Richard Scudamore Premier League donation fund, but you know it's pretty generous.
It's so weird because Wenger must have signed off on it, right? Maybe he was so completely demob happy at that point.
It was just him flicking the V's on his way out.
I think the reality of it is that Emery came in, and the situation was they have a luxury player who's a phenomenally gifted individual on a wage bill that absolutely smashes everything else they've got at the club, and he does things his own way. You know, Mesut has always had his own kind of attitude to training, you know, and Emery has come in with a different attitude, let's say. They're pretty much...
That was so diplomatically put.
Alternatives at the end of the spectrum. And I think with the best will in the world, Emery, he included Mesut Ozil in his captaincy group. He gave him the number 10 shirt. He had, you know, wanted to have big hugs with him, so to speak, and make him feel better after a miserable summer and the aftermath of the World Cup with Germany when he was scapegoat. And I think he tried to bring him in. But Mesut has been at Arsenal for a number of years under Arsene Wenger, kind of doing his own thing, and you know that's his way, that's how he's carried on doing things. And it's obviously there's a massive disconnection there. I do also think when you look at Unai Emery, people are saying, "Come on, you've got to cut him some slack. You've got to do something here. Arsenal aren't that good," which is a fair comment. But if you look at Emery personally, having worked at a big club and had this problem with Neymar, if you've got two so-called quite big clubs on your CV overseas and both of them you've had a massive clash with the best paid star player and you've not been able to handle it,
alarm bells.
How does that look for you going forward? Mm-hmm. So there's an argument that that he's taking out on Mesut Ozil what he suffered on the hands of being the dog getting kicked around by Neymar.
You almost just want to put them both in a room with some soothing music, get them to chat and hug it out.
Well, Emery has said before in an interview, and this was before he took up his position at Arsenal, that, you know, you can only have one person in charge at each club. And he said, you know, at Barcelona, it's Leo Messi. At Real Madrid, it's Florentino Perez. At PSG, it was Neymar. So he obviously is determined to be top dog at Arsenal, and I suspect that's probably a lot of the reason why Ozil has been pushed to the margins.
So we're kind of talking at all levels, from boardroom level to pitch level, a bit of an ego battle going on, which is a worry.
Well, I think that, you know, the club that Arsene Wenger left behind had a load of problems that needed solving, and you know, slowly and slowly they're trying to get through them all. But some of them are a bit thornier than others. And actually, it's all very well saying it might be in your best interest to go, please, Mr. Ozil, but he's got to want to go, and I'm not sure that he does.
No.
Because there's no one's going to take over that contract, so Arsenal, at the very least, will have to subsidise a lot of it. It makes me think, because we do talk a lot about how important it is for a club to have a vision, to have like a holistic sort of joined-up approach, and that might sound like sort of pie-in-the-sky nonsense to a lot of people, and often I can agree with that. But the Arsenal situation is an example of why it's important for a club to have an idea of what direction they're going in, because if they'd have known at the time that they want to be this sort of high-pressing, hard-running team, then they wouldn't have given a massively bonkers deal to Mesut Ozil, because they would have known that that wasn't in their future. But they were, I guess, in this sort of size. There was a going through the sort of shift at Arsenal between being the Wenger thing and not knowing what the future was going to be.
So one player we do know is definitely leaving Arsenal at the end of the season is Petr Cech, 36 years old and announcing his retirement. I personally was really sad when I heard that, and really shocked. What about you guys?
Yeah, I was surprised. I would have thought he has a good 2 years left in him. No one seems to have a bad word to say about him. I've never had any dealings with him, but I presume Amy may have. And he just seems to be an absolutely top bloke. So
he
good
really
luck to
is
him.
A gentleman. He's a pleasure to interview, isn't he? He's one of those people that you can sit down and you could extend your interview by at least an hour just chatting chatting life with him.
Look, he's a drummer. I mean, come on, give him some credit. Have you seen him though? On the kit,
I've not witnessed it. No, I've not
check
witnessed
it out on YouTube. He's quite
brilliant.
Good. He's obviously going to be mostly remembered for his success with Chelsea, where he was exceptional. And he's one of those goalkeepers who, as well as being quite brilliant, has that calmness, which is an amazing quality to have. And I think his value, sort of in the dressing room and around the place, particularly at Chelsea, was, as you know, not as important, but it was a big part of what he gave to them. But also, I mean, I happened to be there at the game against Reading when he had that head injury. And I think, you know, over the midst of the 20 years or whatever that he's played football, you know, yes, you remember it because he wears his headgear, but that was a truly frightening episode.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are still times, actually, I was recently with someone who's a medic, and we were talking about Petacek and his headgear, and the guy was a bit like, well, shaking his head as if to say, why the hell he carried on? You know, the risk that he runs every time he steps out on a football pitch, given the injury he had. And that, frankly, is not going to really protect you.
No.
If there's a serious injury. Kind of made me think that you have to have a certain inner character to
carry on,
to decide that, you know, obviously he was still young and in love with the game, and of course he's going to try, you understand that, but it was still, he's played on for a very, very long time. And I do, you know, you wonder possibly whether part of that is you've done your 20 years and like, let's not continue to make risks when your reactions maybe slightly change as you get older.
Yeah. Chelsea have reportedly ready to offer him a coaching role as well. And, you know, bearing in mind what you said about the impact that he had there, that would be great for them, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always a funny thing with ex-players. You hope to hell that if they come back in a any kind of non-playing role that it's going to work. And I need to look at Manchester United at the moment, how there's something extra, that frisson, if you've got, you know, one of your own, so to speak, who's involved and who can relate the experiences of the past. And it's like a kind of passing the baton of history through present to future in a club. And it's a great thing to have if you can. Paul Pogba, after the Tottenham game the other day, was talking about it and saying how he sort of, it was quite sweet. He kind of went, oh, well, you know, I remember him from when I, you know, in the academy, in the reserves, and everyone called him super sub, and he was sort of giggling. He always went back, reverted to like being a little boy, you know, with the guy who'd done it all, being part of the coaching staff. And I think if you are a young player coming through, and everybody talks about that point in time, particularly with young players, where they're, you know, 18 to 20, 21, and can you get opportunities? That's the point you kind of got to make it, otherwise you tend to drift away or drift down. Having someone who you respect, who can show us your medals, who can give you advice, and who can maybe help you with some of the psychological pitfalls, has got to be a great thing. And yeah, I think it would make bags of sense if Chelsea think that they can have space for him. You don't want to be somewhere at a club just to stand around and be an ex-legend. You want to, you know, I think if you're going to take on a role like that, you want to actually be working.
I don't think that's the kind of role that Petacek would want necessarily.
He won't be doing dressing room tours and corporate talks.
Maybe not, although he might give you a private one. You never know. Arsenal play Chelsea this weekend. Let's talk Gonzalo Higuain. Now, Paolo, you know him quite well from his 5.5 years in Serie A. Mm-hmm. At 31, would you say he has something to offer the Premier League?
I would say that if the deal is indeed what's been mooted this morning, which is a loan deal till the end of the season with an option to extend it next season, I think it's a pretty close to a no-lose scenario for Chelsea. I think it's a great deal. Obviously, under Maurizio Sarri, he had his most productive season ever. He scored 36 goals in 35 games, the most any player has ever scored in a Serie A season, again, despite missing three games. He has had a bad year at Milan. There's no question about that. He's had his sort of longest ever drought in Serie A. He was on a miserable run right up until the last game of 2018. There's a lot that goes into that. I would say that despite still being pretty much on course for the Champions League, Milan have been pretty turgid for a lot of the season. They're missing a lot of players in midfield. There's often been a real absence of a link-up between the midfield and the attack. And Higuain is actually a very selfless player. Like, everyone, because he scores goals, thinks of him as just that. But actually, he's inclined to track back and get involved and try and sort of help build play, which is something that Gattuso was sort of publicly calling him out on, saying, no, you need to just sodding stay in the area so that we can get the ball to you, because when you're back here all the time, you're not where we need you to be. So there is a lot that's gone into his bad form this season. I think it's reasonable to ask, is he, you know, obviously he's a little bit older, a little bit slower, but he was never a player who relied first and foremost on his speed. Clearly, he's a player who relies more on his power and that explosiveness, and I think he still has that. I think you don't forget how to strike a ball all of a sudden. He's obviously an excellent finisher. I think I'm slightly surprised that Juventus have gone for this, because the whole deal to send him to Milan in the first place, this is the boring stuff, but it's all about the amortization rate and how much Juventus sort of need to recoup on the initial 90 million euros they spent on him. And so that's why Milan coughed up a hefty sort of 18 million euro loan fee was the original agreement. I don't know if they're getting some of that back with him going in mid-season, but there's an amount that they need to get back every year. And I thought they wouldn't let this happen with Chelsea without either, because there's talk of an option of extending the loan for Skriniar. I thought it'd have to be an obligation, or there'd be more money involved. If it's half a season, I don't see how Chelsea lose out of it. You potentially get a player who is a manager who he trusts. I think a really interesting thing about Higuain, actually, and I've sort of got this vibe off other people who've spoken to him, and then I had the chance to interview him a little while ago, and I very much got this vibe again off him. He's someone who talks all the time about how he doesn't pay attention to the bad stuff that's being said about him in the press, and talks about it so much that you're quite certain that he does. He really likes to feel wanted. He likes to feel wanted. It's why when he came from Madrid to Naples in the first place, he had a manager in Sarri who wanted him it was Benitez when he first came, wasn't it? But it was Sarri who took it on. I think he talked about Sarri as a manager who made him feel like that. And he then talked, when he went to Milan in the summer, about, oh, there's a club that made me feel like I'm wanted. And I think it hasn't worked out for him at Milan. And Sarri is the perfect guy for him to go back to, because it's the one manager who's felt like, when I was with him, I was the guy, and he trusted me. And of course, it's a different environment in Chelsea, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on him to get in there and start scoring immediately. But I think he's different to what they have. I think he is a goal scorer, despite what I've said about him being someone who drops and gets involved and tracks back. His track record of scoring a lot of goals through pretty much every season where he's been allowed to start as a centre forward is clear and consistent, other than this one. So I think you can view this as the anomaly rather than the rule. I like it. I think it'll be really fascinating to see him in the Premier League and see how he does.
Yeah, and of course, sorry, Lars.
It's got to be a big help that he already knows roughly what Sarri wants from a striker in his system, all the patterns and all of this. But
yeah, and Jorginho as well. You've got an instant sort of reconnection.
Sorry to be a massive bore, but do you know anything yet about like who's covering his salary? Because he's on basically Mesut Ozil money, and so Chelsea being reluctant to spend a lot of money on old dudes, it's you wonder.
There's no way that Juventus would have agreed to this without getting his salary off the books. The whole reason that they had to get him out this summer is because they signed Cristiano Ronaldo and made him an incredibly highly paid player. The details of the transfer are only just sort of coming through this morning, so I can't say categorically I have seen something, but I mean, I cannot conceive a scenario in which Juventus would have agreed to let him go without the wages being paid.
Because even if it's just a loan, that makes it quite an expensive deal for the club. And sure. It does bring you back to when Conte really wanted Dzeko, and the deal could possibly have been made, but Chelsea was like, no, it's too much money for an old dude. And they ended up signing Giroud, which was a kind of compromise that wasn't really great for anyone. And it's slightly odd in that regard that they're willing to go with it when they weren't.
Yeah, well, I think that's why it's so important for everyone. I suppose it's a loan till the end of the season with an option to extend it, rather than any, you know, for Chelsea have clearly got what they wanted, if that is indeed the structure of it, that they haven't got an obligation, that they're not going to be lumbered with this if it doesn't work out. I think you can justify the cost of half a season's wages to find out, because if he comes in and scores 15 goals in the second half of the season, then obviously it's a great deal. If it gets you in the Champions League, it's already repaid itself.
Absolutely. 6 points between Arsenal and Chelsea as it stands. Arsenal could cut it to 3 or Chelsea extend to 9. Obviously, I know you don't get too excited, Barry, about anything, but are you excited about this one?
Not really. I think I would be excited if Arsenal turn up and play well. I have a feeling that might not happen. But, yeah, they do raise their game sometimes against high-quality opposition. But, yeah, you just, much like in the Wenger era, I'm never quite sure which Arsenal are going to turn up. So if they turn up and give Chelsea a decent game, yeah, it could be a belter.
Anyone else excited? No.
Well.
Okay, well, I am.
I mean, as an Arsenal fan, nervous. I mean, interested, excited would make it sound like I'm optimistic for the outcome, which I'm not. So.
And there is the answer we needed. Thank you very much, Amy Lawrence, for joining us. Fascinating insight into Arsenal. That's the end of part two. In part three, we're going to be talking about the FA Cup action from this week and looking forward to the weekend's Premier League fixtures. Welcome to part three. Feeling a little bit left out because the live shows are next week in January, the Liberty Hall Theatre in Dublin on the 21st and 22nd. And three of the four panellists will be there. Barry, Paolo and Lars all joining Max on the 21st. Last few tickets remaining for that. 2 days you've got. How lucky are you lot? Because it's sold out on the 22nd. So get your last few tickets. All excited?
It was presented by a presumably jet-lagged Max Rushton. I mean, that could be very interesting.
Yeah, I suspect I'll be doing a lot of heavy lifting with him on the radio this week. heavy lifting for him. But yes, we will chat the Liberty Hall Theatre to its very foundations.
I'm very excited to hear what shenanigans go on when I see you all afterwards. Right, FA Cup last night, Southampton 2, Derby County 2. And Derby go through on penalties. That was the last FA Cup third round replay last night. It was a repeat of the first leg, Southampton leading 2-0 before being pegged back by Derby. Nathan Redmond scored 3 of Southampton's 4 goals across both matches and then was the only player to miss a penalty in the shootout. Got to feel a little bit sorry for him. Nick Harris at Sporting Intel with some stats. Southampton have led 2-0 and not won fairly recently against Derby twice now, Man United, Brighton and Chelsea, which is not a great stat for Ralph Hasenhüttl to look at. VAR brought back in again. Craig Bryson's goal ruled offside. 2.5 minutes it took them for that decision. What do you reckon? Clear offside, Barry?
I wouldn't say clear. He was offside. I mean, I've no problem with the VAR on this one. It was correct. I think it's the offside rule perhaps needs a bit of tinkering with because, you know, there's no way a linesman could confidently flag that one way or the other, you know. And
what was it, his leg?
A foot, I think.
A
you know.
Foot. Unbelievable.
Yeah, but those are the matter. But, you know, you can't be, much like you can't be a little bit pregnant, you can't be a little bit offside. You either are or you aren't, you know. But, yeah, VAR is being introduced so that we no longer have these debates that we keep having despite the introduction of VAR. And I still can't decide whether I want it in or not, but it continues to be a talking point. But yeah, that was fractionally offside. So.
I guess it was sort of a condensed version of the whole VAR debate there, because the decision was correct, but it took a while. And it doesn't sit right when you've had the whole goal celebration and you go back to at the kickoff and then you go, oh, no, that's been chalked off. That feels like it's against the spirit of the whole sport to me. But
see, the problem is that this is exactly the sort of thing that's come up in Italy this season, is that the directive they've given to linesmen in Italy, which has not been uniformly followed, but is that they should not raise their flag if they think it's even a little bit in doubt, because it's better to let the action finish and then review it on VAR and get it right than to raise your flag, cause the referee to whistle, stop the play when you might have had someone through on goal. In fact, we had a linesman being criticised for not doing that just in the Supercoppa on Wednesday night, but that is the directive that they've given in Italy. So actually, you should have the goal and the celebration before finding out the answer, which I can see the emotional frustration with that, but it is, from a getting the right outcome point of view, it does make sense.
In similar VAR news, sorry, just really quickly, at Marseille-Monaco at the weekend in the second half, was a very strange situation because it was 1-1 in the second half. Now, Marseille scored a goal to make it 2-1, After which Marseille then took off Dimitri Payet to give him a rest, and Monaco took off a midfielder and put on a striker because they had to change the game. And then after those subs had been made, goal went to VAR and got ruled out. So it went back to 1-1 with both teams having made substitutions thinking it was 2-1. And that's a slightly sort of complicated and iffy situation, I think, for the whole VAR thing.
I think they should not have let those substitutions happen.
Yeah, no, honestly, the official should go hang on. There might be something going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stoke 2, Shrewsbury Town 3. Talking about teams throwing away a two-goal lead. The League One side, who are 3 points above the relegation places, came from 2 goals down to beat Stoke at the Bet365. I personally was delighted when I saw that, despite walking out of Kenilworth Road having lost 1-0 to Sheffield Wednesday with Nathan Jones going to Stoke. That made me happy and I don't feel bad about it. Stoke made 8 changes. 19-year-old Tyrese Campbell in his first start put them 2 up, but they conceded 3 goals in 10 minutes. I mean, yeah, oh dear. James Bolton, who's a Shrewsbury defender, is actually a Stoke fan as well. So he got their first goal. But he's claiming the second goal as well because it was actually scored with his boots. Okunbiri basically borrowed his boots because his studs were hurting and then went on to score the penalty. So, yes, anyway, Josh Lauren got the winner on 81.
Make me think of Deadeye Keane in Roy of the Rovers. Wasn't that oh my God! Is no one here read Roy of the Rovers?
Oh no, I'm familiar with Deadeye Keane, but I'm
well. It was the kid who was wearing Deadeye Keane's boots. Run the boots. Billy's boots. That's what it is. Yeah.
Well, Shrewsbury are rewarded with a fourth round tie at home against Premier League neighbours Wolves, which is their manager Sam Ricketts' former club. Blackburn Rovers 2, Newcastle United 4. Feel a bit sorry for Blackburn. Anyone? 2-0 down, got themselves back to 2-2. Newcastle in extra time went 3-2 up. That goal looked to be offside and was scored way after the first half of extra time should have ended.
One thing that occurred to me, I think extra time needs to be eliminated from the FA Cup and all of football perhaps, but there's no need for it. I do feel sorry for Blackburn because they got themselves back into it and Bradley Dack then missed a chance he would expect to score in his sleep. Which was unfortunate for them. It's kind of, well, if I wasn't a Sunderland fan, I'd feel a little bit sorry for Newcastle as well, because I think they clearly weren't that bothered about advancing in the FA Cup. The last thing they needed was extra time, and they've lost, I think, 1, 2, 3. Kieran Clark, Jamal Lascelles, Isaac Hayden and Fabian Schär all finished the game injured and maybe unavailable for a while. And Newcastle just don't have the bodies to sort of deal with those kind of absences.
Yeah, Benitez says he'll rotate his squad. He said it's a bit of a bonus for them, so not that exciting. And they face Watford in round 4, which does not really get me going, to be honest. Luton Town 0, Sheffield Wednesday 1.
What does get you going, Faye?
Not this game, that's for sure. Well, the game itself got me going. It was a cracking game of football. Atmosphere at Kenilworth Road was absolutely amazing. Personally, I thought we could have done with VAR because from the angle I was at, I thought Atinuyu controlled the ball with his arm before poking it home at the start of the second half. But I've not seen a replay, so I cannot guarantee that. Gutted to be out of the cup, but we've got Peterborough in the league this weekend, and that is far more important. And Sheffield Wednesday will set up a fourth round tie at Chelsea, which will still just be before Steve Bruce takes up his new position. But I don't want to go. I don't want to harp on at Luton. I've already had tweets from everybody saying, and from Max Rushton, saying you cannot have more than a minute of Luton Town talk. So I've probably just gone over that. But I do just want to mention our new stadium, which we were given approval for last night. It's a two-stage process, really, because in order to pay for the new stadium, we need a kind of retail and housing development to be approved as well. And we won't hear about that for another 2 weeks. But this is huge news for my club. Everybody is so excited. 70 odd years we've been talking about a new stadium. Gary Sweet stood up, our managing director, at the planning meeting yesterday and gave a rousing talk about why this is so important, not just for the football club and our ambitions in the future, but also for the town itself and surrounding areas, and it's huge. And I know any other football fans out there who've faced, you know, time delays and discussions of new grounds that have never surfaced or have eventually will know exactly what all of us Luton fans have been going through. But I've gone over a minute, Max, and apologies for that, but I'm not that sorry.
Definitely more than a minute there.
And none of you were with me either. Right, this weekend's Premier League, Liverpool against Crystal Palace. Liverpool have the chance to go 7 points clear of Man City again because City aren't playing Huddersfield until Sunday. But Trent Alexander-Arnold out injured for at least a fortnight or so. And that, frustratingly, is just days after Nathaniel Clyne went out on loan. Defensive injuries have been a real problem, haven't they?
Yeah, Neil Warnock will be laughing up his sleeve over that one. But I suppose with this game, it's Roy Hodgson going back to Anfield, where he's incredibly unpopular. And it would be really funny if Crystal Palace did sort of trip Liverpool up with Roy Hodgson in charge. But I can't see it happening, to be honest.
You can't see it?
No. But, you know, weirder things have happened. Yeah, but
weirder things happened when Crystal Palace went to Man City and won. So.
Well, yes, indeed.
These things happen quite often in the Premier League this season. So never, ever say never. Wolves against Leicester. I mean, yeah, one of those kind of mid-table.
Well, the two teams that you're never quite sure what you're going to get with either of them. Mm. So I couldn't dream of predicting this. I think I'd probably, if you put a gun to my head, I'd back Wolves. I think there'll be a lot of goals on this one, but
potentially no Bowley, which is obviously
a big thing for Wolves. But if Leicester lost this, you know, we've talked about on the pod plenty of times before the pressure that Claude Puel is under, perhaps unfairly, some people think. But if they don't beat Wolves, will they turn on him again?
So I've thought a lot about this, and I mean, Leicester are an eighth. They're 1 point off the Everton Cup, so and they're probably on balance the eighth best squad in the league on paper. I think that's a pretty fair shout. So you could say that it's harsh for the fans to be as anti-Puel as a lot of them seem to be. But I'm going to try to understand where the fans are coming from here as well. I think when you're in that cluster of teams who are not going to get Champions League almost no matter what happens, unless they have a freak season, are not going to get relegated unless everything goes spectacularly wrong, I think for the fans it's really important that there's something about the team that gets them excited. Like when you go to work every day and you're bored and you want to daydream and you think about the team you support, you have to have reasons why you're excited about watching this team at the weekend, something to get you going. Something it doesn't necessarily have to play like Pep's Barcelona. I'm sure under like the peak Pulis years, the Stoke fans were really excited about watching their team put one on the overpaid foreigners who came to the Britannia. It's got to be something that you identify with that really gets you going. And I think Leicester fans, like, are they that excited about watching like Nampalis Mendy trundling about to no great effect? You know, the Puel thing, like every public appearance he makes is like an elephant dart to the face. You know, there's got to be something about them that makes you look forward to going to the games when you paid your money to go.
And I get that, but equally, they've had exciting seasons, and maybe this is just one that is just gonna, you know,
it's like Claude Puel is not going to get them relegated. But that's not like
and a few
great,
seasons ago that was a great
that,
thing.
Don't put that on a
them.
Bus, you know.
Yeah, I suppose I get where Lars is coming from, because it's not just about not getting relegated. There's ways and ways to not get relegated, right? They've scored the fewest goals in the top half of the league. They're not fun.
Yeah,
I think that's the thing. You can be in the middle of the table and be fun, or you can be in the middle of the table and just be.
Yeah, if you're a forklift driver in Leicester and you're sort of thinking about the game at the weekend, like, what is it about watching Leicester right now that's making you wildly excited about going to that game? It's probably not that much. And I think that is a big problem for Puel, in the same way it is always a problem for the mid-table teams when you're in that position.
Well, you know, West Ham fans might be excited about going to Bournemouth this weekend after they beat Arsenal last weekend. Be interesting to see whether Marko Arnautović makes an appearance with this apparent, inverted commas, back injury Manuel Pellegrini mentioned. Manchester United, Brighton. United are on a roll, obviously, under Solskjaer at the moment. Cracking result at Wembley. Why are we still talking about whether or not he's going to get the permanent role? Can we not just wait till the end of the season?
Yeah, let's wait till the end of the season. But top of the Solskjaer table still, which is the real quiz, as we all know.
Say that again.
He's top of the Solskjaer table.
He's top of the Solskjaer table.
Which is the table of the Premier League since he took over.
All just looked at you blankly.
Yeah, that's because you don't read Norwegian newspapers.
There's a very good reason for that, Lars. Yeah.
Now I have no desire to.
But the big one...
There is a website dedicated to the Solskjaer table.
Wow.
Which is possibly the most important table in the world, and he's still top.
Can I say, please don't give me it. Newcastle versus Cardiff. We've touched on this already. A huge game for both sides. 17th versus 18th. Who's going to come out on top, Paolo?
If I was Newcastle, why have you used up all your goals for the season in that game against Blackburn? I mean, they're so... I don't know, maybe that carries over. Maybe you get a little bit of enthusiasm just from winning a game, even if it is sort of a bit of a slog to get there in extra time. But my worry would be heavy legs after that. Yeah, as Baz said, you don't need 120 minutes in midweek at the time when you're fighting relegation.
So Neil Warnock rubbing his hands with glee, potentially.
It's the team with the second worst home record in the league facing the team with the second worst away record. So that's wild times at St James's this weekend, I think.
Southampton versus Everton and Watford versus Burnley make up the rest of the fixtures on Saturday. On Sunday, we've mentioned Huddersfield's gigantuan task, potentially. I don't know if I'm overstating that and being really not very kind to Huddersfield fans, but they face Manchester City on Sunday, followed by Fulham against Tottenham, which I'm going to. We cannot finish the pod without talking about the issues that Tottenham face going into this game. No Harry Kane, potentially out until the beginning of March, and their midfield is ravaged as well. Heung-min Son away for potentially 5 matches with South Korea at the Asian Cup. Sissoko could be out for a month. Winks, they still want to kind of, you know, keep an eye on. Moura's coming back from injury as well, and Dembele's about to move to China. What are they going to do?
Well, I mean, Kane has started 151 out of Tottenham's 174 league games under Pochettino, and in those games they have a 60% win ratio, which Tim Sherwood will tell you is second to none. Now, the team will score an average of 2 goals per game with Kane in it. It's interesting that without Kane, the win rate only drops by about 3%, so they have been getting results without him, but the average goals drops to 1.6, so they do struggle to score at the same rate without him. That is a significant difference, and you wonder, with Son not there to pick up the slack, that's a real issue for them. Dembele, like, he's had so many little injuries, his contract running down. I think it's a good job by them to get money for him, really, given their financial situation, but they certainly need bodies in midfield somehow.
Yeah, they need bodies in midfield, but it's also crucially a very big time for Spurs at the moment. He's going to miss some massive games because he's going to be out for at least the first leg of their last 16 Champions League tie with Borussia Dortmund on the 13th of February as well.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's the absence of Son that compounds it, because I look at this team and I think if there's any one team that Lars has actually provided statistics, which is a far more, you know, accurate way of sort of articulating this than my sort of personal impression. But I've always looked at the team and thought, well, okay, yeah, Harry Kane's great, but if you take him out, there's still plenty of goals in that team, aren't there? It's not like you're struggling to think of someone who can score for you. If you take Kane and Son out, then you start to think, okay, well, you know, there's still guys who can score goals. You're still Dele Alli, still Christian Eriksen, you've still got guys who can do it, but you're just a little bit less flexible in terms of your options. And certainly, you know, it's the depth of options that have been such an asset to Pochettino and team in terms of being able to bring players off the bench as well.
And Llorente
won't someone think of Vincent Janssen?
I don't think Vincent Janssen's been playing with the under 23s.
Yes, I suspect Poch would rather send out 10 men than 11 with him included.
But equally, I don't think Fernando Llorente is, you know, first and foremost his choice to be leading the line.
Yeah, there was talk, which could be utter cobblers, in the papers this morning that perhaps they might try to get Divock Origi in on loan from Liverpool. So
it's an inspiring signing.
It's not going to get anyone's pulse racing, but
it does beg the question, are they going to have to do something in January?
But I mean, if they don't have any money to spend, and there are limits to what you can do, so you end up with a sort of Divock thing.
The Divock thing. Lovely. Now, listen, you need to explain something to me, and forgive me, I forget.
Is it about the Solskjaer table?
No, it's not about, funnily enough, Lars, no, it's not. It is, you know, when he was in Liverpool, I remembered. Is it Babel or Babel, for start? Babel.
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 Babel, right. Okay, so Ryan Babel joined Fulham, moved from Besiktas, 32 years old now. Why so much excitement? I was going through all the tweets when I said that I was doing the pod today, and I was going through all the tweets about the excitement. Does Max have some kind of obsession that I don't know about?
I think this goes back to last season when I think we all thought Ryan Babel had actually retired or was, you know, playing out his dotage in Dutch non-league football. And it turned out he was at Fenerbahce. And just for one reason or another... Beşiktaş. And for one reason or another, he ended up being mentioned in every single podcast for about 25 of them in a row.
Wow.
And then we got to the point where we just gratuitously mentioned it, him just to keep it going. And then was it Jonathan Wilson or someone went to interview him? And anyway, he sort of went off the radar then. And now he's very much back on it.
Taking a running gag and stretching it to the point where it's just annoying is so unlike Max. I'm surprised that this is something that's happened. It is odd. I'm sure Fulham have other transfer plans this January. They must have. But just looking at their squad, looking at their games this season, I mean, they have some quite good guys going forward. And their defence has at times been a bit of a freak show. And so that you decide to bring in a 32-year-old Ryan Babel is an odd sort of priority to make. But I can only assume they have more plans between now and deadline day.
Do you think, bearing in mind Tottenham's troubles, that Fulham will think they could get something out of this game?
I would imagine they'll think they can get something out of it. I don't think they will actually get something out of it. But again, you never know. But... It's an easy enough one for Spurs. You know, if they had to handpick opposition to play at this time when they're stretched to the limit, you can't really think of it. But beyond Huddersfield, who else would they go for?
Mm. Right, now, Juventus against Milan in the Supercoppa, Paolo. Mm-hmm. This was last night in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. Juventus won 1-0 with a goal from Cristiano Ronaldo. How has a Saudi Arabian Supercoppa gone down in Italy?
Not great. I mean, I think a lot of people probably just ignored it, but certainly the domestic broadcaster Rai, who had the rights to it, described the situation. You know, they broadcast it, but they described it as absurd and unacceptable in a statement. You know, there's a lot of people who feel like, given what happened with Khashoggi and just general. All sorts of human rights concerns about what happens in the country, and the fact that it's being played abroad is nothing new. I mean, the Supercoppa has been played in the last 10 years 7 times outside of Italy. Now, a lot of those were in China. They played it in Qatar. It's a sort of a pretty standard move at this point, and it's all about making money. I mean, the league gets 20 million euros out of this, and the two clubs get 3.5 million euros each. It's not a game-changing amount of money, but to play a friendly could do worse. Glorified friendly. I mean, you know, Ronaldo was quick to tweet it as his first trophy Juventus, so different people take it different levels of serious. A lot of people have reservations about going to play, yes, again, a game in a country where there's so much questionable stuff going on, where I saw an interview just this week, and I think it was Corriere della Sera with a female Milan fan who said, well, they had, you know, women were allowed in the stadium. That's a new thing that's happened in Saudi Arabia. I couldn't tell you the exact timeline, but it's recent. But they'd have to go and sit in their family section, and the specific areas they're allowed to sit in, they're not allowed everywhere in the stadium. And she's like, well, I can't go. I go every week with the same people to Milan games, and I can't go and sit with my friends, so I'm not going to travel. Of course, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter. They sold the stadium out. They made what they needed out of it. But I think that sort of thing has been noticed in Italy, and people aren't thrilled about it. But again, it's to an extent, when you've already had this game played in Qatar a few times, it's not like you're sort of doing something that's completely a dramatic departure from what's happened before.
So Damien Duff to Celtic is a bit of a gear change. He's joined as a team coach for the reserves. Barry said coaching at Celtic's the next best thing to playing for the club. He's also warned his players that he thinks modern players don't work hard enough, saying you have to do more than enough every day and empty the tank. I would have done anything when I was a kid, 16 years old, being a footballer. I would even have run over my granny.
Oh, that's very nice, Damien. I believe Damien has previous working in charge of this Shamrock Rovers youth team in Dublin, and I think his work ethic apparently is Bielsian, and so I would imagine Celtic's youth players are going to have their little legs run into the ground, and sure, why not, they're full of energy and it'll keep them out of mischief and off the streets.
Lovely stuff. How are you all going to be keeping out of mischief this week?
I think I'm in the office here most of the rest of it, so yeah, that'll keep me out of trouble.
Lars?
I'm going to get a haircut.
Lovely. Amy Lawrence described your hair as a bedhead.
Well, I mean, in the front bit, I mean, there's not much going on there. Like, I'm increasingly going quite bald around the front, and that makes me very nervous about getting any kind of haircut because you don't know how much will grow back. But now it just doesn't look good at all, so I need to do something.
Right, okay. Well, no haircut.
It's exciting news there.
Yeah,
for the
very exciting news. Well, thank you for...
What gantry can we expect to see you in on Saturday afternoon?
I will be...
Perishing with the cold?
I will be perishing at Nottingham Forest, Bristol City. So there for Martin O'Neill's first game in charge, which will be an exciting one. Not so exciting going on the gantry at Nottingham Forest, where you have to walk and duck and walk and duck and walk and duck all the way to the end, which is slightly perilous. And then I'm at Fulham for Fulham Tottenham on Sunday. Very exciting. Thank you all for holding my hand on my debut pod. Mr. Max Rushton is back on Monday. The live shows are on Monday and Tuesday. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.